just, because it's audio, we'll introduce ourselves.
No problem.
So if we can start with yourself,
Martin. So my name is Martin Hewitt, and I am one of the assistant commissioners at the Metropolitan Police Service.
My name is Angel Turcek. I'm studying business studies at LSST, and I'm the Student Union Vice President as well.
I'm Kunal Chandmehta, and I work at LSST's press office.
I am Renata Carvalho, and I am acting as a student president for London School of Science and Technology.
My name is Attila Seb, and I'm a first year student in the LSST IT.
Okay.
IT professional. Okay.
So, any questions?
Sir, Mr. AC Hewitt, you sit on the Metropolitan Senior Management Board. How would you describe your role and duties?
Okay, so so the Management Board is the group at the top of the organisation that obviously runs the organisation in all its different aspects. So the Met is a very big organisation. We've got probably about 45,000 people work for the Met, so that's just over 30,000 police officers, and then the rest are police staff who support us in different ways. And then on top of that, we have about 3,000 volunteer police officers, so special constables who volunteer their time to help and work with police. And we also, across London, have 5,000 police cadets who are youngsters from 10 to 18 years old. So it's a bit like being in the Scouts or in the Army Cadets, but we have and we run that in every borough of London. So big organisation with a big reach. Our budget every year is about just under £3.5 billion is the budget that the Met has to manage. So as the Management Board, so you have the Commissioner and the Deputy Commissioner, and then you have four assistant commissioners who look after different parts of the organisation. And we're responsible collectively as a team with our non-police officer board members, because we have a board member who's our chief information officer or chief technology officer, and then we have a corporate services board member who looks after all those other functions that support policing. And we set the strategy for the organisation. We are in charge in terms of control for operationally for the organisation as well, in terms of dealing with any significant issues that will come up. And then we obviously lead all of those people below us that are actually out and delivering the work. So it's the sort of the top of the organisation and trying to set the tone. A big part of our responsibility is working within the political governance arrangements. So we work with the Mayor of London and the Deputy Mayor for Policing and Crime. We spend a lot of time working with them because they have the governance and accountability for policing. So it's ultimately their responsibility to make sure that we are efficient and effective. And then we also work with local government across the 32 boroughs in London. And then the unique elements about the Met Police are that we also have a national lead around a number of serious crime issues, but particularly we have the national lead for counter-terrorism and protection. So one of the assistant commissioners is responsible for counter-terrorism and protection. So the protection element is in protecting the main government and royal buildings in London, and then protecting those people that get protection, which is largely politicians and royal family. So there are people who have protection. So we run that nationally. And then, obviously, day-to-day, managing policing across London.
Thank you. What made you join the Metropolitan?
Yeah, wow, that's a good question, really. So I've been a police officer for 26 years now. Not originally in the Met, so originally I joined the police in Kent. And then I came up to the Met 14 years ago. Why did I want to come here? One, it's the biggest police force by a considerable distance, and you can get unique policing challenges here, which I wanted to come and try and get involved in. I am also a Londoner, so I was born and bred in London, but I've gone and done all sorts of different things, and I wanted to come back and have the chance to be a senior police officer in London. And it's just kind of the most exciting. There are things you can do here policing-wise that you can't do anywhere else. You know, policing is the same anywhere in reality, but what London offers, you know, it's the most global city in the world. So you've got pretty much every community you could possibly think of. You've got incredible wealth right next door to terrible deprivation, literally next door to one another in some places. You've got the challenge of all the different elements of London. You've got government here. You've got all of the activity that comes into this city. So I think as a police officer and as a senior police officer, if you want to have that challenge, then you can only get it here, really. So that's why I wanted to come back here, and that's what I did, as I say, 14 years ago. So, yeah, and I enjoy it. It's good.
Thank you. I have a few questions about tackling knife crime and violence in London. What are the key drivers for knife crime?
So I think there's a number of factors, and I guess the overall message I would say is lots of people try and find a simple answer that says this is why this is happening or that's happening. And the fact is there isn't a simple one single answer, because if there was, then we would all get on and deal with it. I think you've got a number of factors in play. I think there is there are groups within our society where you've got young people, and I know we'll come on to it a little bit later, but much more prepared to carry weapons with them all the time. And the thing about that is, if people are carrying a knife, when they inevitably end up in some sort of conflict, then you are automatically in a much more dangerous situation, because people will take those knives, and then if they get used, then it's incredibly dangerous. So I think there are many more people carrying the knives, and we'll come on and talk about a little bit why I think that's the case.
Certainly.
There is no doubt that the drugs business is driving quite a bit of the violence that we are seeing. And by that, I don't mean people who are on drugs committing violence. I mean drugs as a business, and a very profitable business, and people then protecting or creating markets or protecting markets, drug markets, and then they will use violence to allow them to do that. I think one of the other phenomena that we've seen, and you know, you talk about teenagers, but there are younger people getting drawn into this. And some of the drug activity that we're seeing at the moment, where particularly groups from big cities are going out to smaller towns and taking over the drug markets there, which is causing violence in those places. But it's also drawing younger people into this. So very young children are being used to carry the drugs from one place to another. And what that does is it exposes them to the violence, it exposes them to criminality. Then they have to start proving themselves, to prove that they can stay with the group. And they start taking part in violence, and then you're into quite a cycle then where it's really hard for them to get out of that cycle. You've also got, I think, the social media element does cause me concern, and we talk about that quite a lot, and some people kind of throw back, and I'm not trying to be the kind of morality police or anything like that, but the simple fact is young people now are being exposed to much more violent imagery, whether it's in the games or whether it's in what comes on social media. And that, at the very least, is normalising violent behaviour. You know, all the videos that are on YouTube of people hanging around, flashing knives, sometimes even flashing weapons, using aggressive language, making threats, challenging people. All of that, at the very least, it normalises it. It glamorises it. And so you're getting people drawn into being involved in this because they think it's cool, quite frankly, because all of us, when we're 15, want to know what the cool thing is. And I just think now you're getting this, and the social media and the videos are causing acts of violence. And I can point you to murders that have happened in London in the recent past, where we know that the reason that murder happened was because the person who was killed taunted the other person on a video on social media. So they will go to that person's area, they will taunt them, try and humiliate them, and then the other person goes and acts. So you're into this cycle where it's kind of regenerating it. And I think, I have to say, I do think the way that it's all portrayed in the media becomes a bit of a cyclical thing, because I do think that some people are genuinely concerned for their own safety, which is why they carry a weapon, because they see all that they see. But of course, once you've got a weapon and you end up in an argument and people take weapons out. So I think there's a whole range of things coming together. And then finally, what I would say, this is not happening across all groups in London. It's not happening across all parts of London. And there is something about a cohort of young people who do not feel that they've got good life chances, and so they are drawn into this kind of behaviour, and they think that's just how it is, which for many, many young people isn't at all. But there's a group, and I think we have got to look at what has been the impact of the kind of 10 years of austerity, I think, has left some communities behind in terms of all the services and facilities. And you've got a bunch of youngsters who look and think, that's the most attractive lifestyle for me, where I can get status and I can get some money and I can have a bit of protection, and they get drawn in. And once you're drawn in, it's incredibly difficult to get yourself out.
Are more teenagers carrying knives?
Yeah, I think they are.
Why do you think is this?
I think they are. Yeah. Well, I think our evidence would show that when you look at the literally thousands of weapons that we are taking off people on the streets in any given year. I think there's a range of factors. I do believe in certain places and in certain communities, people are carrying them because they are fearful. They are worried because they see so much. They will know people that have been attacked and stabbed, been robbed, and they think, I need to have something to at least protect myself. And I did a TV program about violence, and what was really sad there, that one of the adults in that group was a parent, and she said that, I tell my son to carry a knife because I'm worried about his own safety when he's moving around. So there is an element of fear, but that is not the only element. And I think sometimes people want to portray it as that. There is also a bit of bravado. There is also a bit of feeling powerful and status. There is also a bit of trying to prove yourself to your peers, to show that you're cool and you're tough. And that kind of, what I think in some communities, quite honestly, is a fairly distorted sense of what being a man is and what masculinity is and power. And there's a bit of that as well. And then there will be a small group who are going out and they are intent on harming other people. And we must not forget that there is that group as well, because I get a little frustrated that sometimes commentary will suggest that it's all, you know, innocent kids who are just so scared that they're carrying a knife. There are some of those, don't get me wrong, but there are equally others who are going out there because this is how they control what they control, and this is how they think they're powerful.
What is your message of reassurance to Londoners? For example, London is still one of the safest cities.
And it absolutely is, and it still is an incredibly safe city. When you think that, whatever the census figures would say, there's probably on any given day near enough 10 million people in this city. As I said, we've got every part of the world reflected, and on the whole, people rub along and things are not too bad. There is far too much knife violence, absolutely, and there are far too many people, and often young people, being hurt with knives and sadly dying as a result of knife injuries. But London is still incredibly safe. The statistics that, you know, you mentioned the New York thing, it is a ludicrous comparison, quite frankly, to compare us to New York. And the murder figures for 2018 in New York were over twice the number they were in London. And if you actually go to some other US cities where they're even smaller, I mean, Chicago had just under 500 murders last year, and that's a city of 3 million people. So I think we've got to keep it in perspective. And London is still, for most people, safe, a safe city. And we are working really hard to make it as safe as we can. But that doesn't take away there is too much violence. There are too many people being injured with knives. There are too many young people being injured with knives. And in particular communities, it is particularly prevalent. And, you know, we've just got to all keep going on that. But there is something about everyone trying to be conscious about not just talking it down all the time, because it just becomes this kind of received wisdom that no one's safe to walk to the shop. And I don't believe that. There are incidents, of course there are, but there always have been and there always will be in a big city with lots of people crammed together. But I do think we've all got a responsibility not to allow this to become something that it isn't. Because the thing with crime, and I've dealt with it for a lot of years, there is the reality of crime that will obviously have an impact on people, but then there is the perception of crime, and it worries me at the moment that the perception of London is that it is, you know, everywhere is completely dangerous and you couldn't possibly move around. Now, well, that's not our experience of being in London, but it is still too much, and in some places it's definitely too much.
Will an increase in stop and search, a tactic often seen as intrusive, yep, help reduce that crime?
So stop and search is intrusive, so there's no getting away from that. You probably won't be surprised that I am supportive of stop and search when it's done properly. And that's the key point. And I have been involved in dealing with stop and search forever, really. And in London, stop and search is probably the most iconic issue about policing, and particularly with the black community. So young black men and the Met Police is probably our most challenging relationship, because of there is an entire history between the two, between us and them as a community, from really the kind of 50s and 60s, but certainly once you get into the 70s and the 80s, when I was growing up in London and you had the riots in the 80s, and that is a really challenged relationship. But even in all the debates, and I've been in some places where people have been absolutely shouting and screaming at us about stop and search, but no one ever says we shouldn't be able to do it. And when you then talk to the parents of children who've been stabbed or been killed, or you talk to communities where this is prevalent, they will want us to be doing stopping and searching. Because I know it sounds almost stupid, but you can't stab someone if you haven't got a knife in your hand. And the problem with knives is we could all go now, and in the next 10 minutes probably, we could all get hold of a knife, because they're everywhere, aren't they? And certainly in everyone's home and restaurant and all the rest of it. You know, if you talk about guns, it's really hard to get a proper firearm still, thankfully, in this country, and then get the right ammunition and be in the right place at the right time. It's a lot of risk and it's hard for people. We can all get knives, and now you can buy them off the internet, which is ridiculous, but anyway. So we have got to be stopping and searching people. We have got to do everything we can do to take knives out of people's pockets. We've got to do everything we can do to make people concerned that if I'm carrying a knife, I might get stopped by the police, and then I might get arrested, because that will save people's lives. And I have sat with too many parents of children who've been stabbed to death, who will say, you know, if someone had been there, if some police officer had stopped that person an hour before they killed my child, then they might not be where they are now. But we've got to do it properly. We've got to do it respectfully with people. You can't just be completely disrespectful to someone because you're searching them. But it's so hard for us to get that encounter right when both sides turn up with all that history. Because for the, you know, often the black lads, there is a load of history and they might have their own experience. So they're all ready. And to be honest, with our officers as well, even if they're relatively new, they take on all of our history and all of what they pick up when you become part of this organisation. So before either of these two people does something stupid, it's already quite tense, and we've just got to constantly, constantly work with our officers. We refresh the training, we bring in all sorts of challenge around that. On every borough, there'll be a stop and search monitoring group, which will be members of the community who will challenge the local police about the way they're doing stop and search. When we do big operations where we're going to stop lots of people, they will come out and be part of that operation. And of course, the really positive thing now about stop and search in the last couple of years is the body-worn video. So every operational police officer is carrying body-worn video, and they will switch that on when they are conducting a stop search. So that gives us that record of exactly what's happened in that encounter. And that, I think, is a positive thing. And you can say to the person you're searching that this is being filmed, so they know that if you behave in a way that you shouldn't behave. But it's a real conflict point with us, and particularly with young people generally, but particularly young black men. But it will save people's lives if we're taking knives off the street, and people need to feel our presence, particularly in those places where there is far too much violence.
I have three questions based on victim and offenders.
Yes.
Question one is, what are the main misconceptions for those that carry or use a knife?
Yeah.
For example, it is fine if I stab someone in a place that won't kill them.
Yeah. So I would say, so that is definitely one of the misconceptions. And I, you know, when I talked about the video, the kind of online stuff, What worries me a little bit is you watch some of the games that people watch and play, and it's just all violence. And of course, doing that is all without any consequence, without any comeback. Then they watch the kind of video stuff, and most people have no idea how easy it is to stab somebody with a pointed blade, how easily that will go in, because it will go in very easily. And then it is simply luck as to whether that person survives. So a bit of luck as to where it goes, but even where you think it might be perfectly safe, you can still have someone die as a result of that. It's luck at how quickly we get there, or how quickly the officers get there, who will all do now, are all pretty much able to do what you would have described as trauma medicine previously, and our ability. And then you get the paramedics, and then you get the doctors, so the helicopter doctor who will be out there, and who are often conducting open heart surgery on the pavement in London. I mean, it's incredible what they do. And then obviously the trauma centres. There is no safe place to stab somebody. There really isn't a safe place to stab somebody. And if you are unlucky, they can be dead almost instantaneously. You know, you clip someone's femoral artery and they are going to die unless someone gets there almost immediately. Or you clip another artery, or you hit a, you know, you hit a major organ, which you won't know what the likelihood of that is. And of course, you never know what underlying conditions any individual might have. So the concept that you can safely stab someone is ridiculous and incredibly dangerous. And I honestly think that sometimes they don't realise how easy this thing is going to go in. And at that moment where your red mist is up and they're wanting to prove themselves and they're not thinking about any of the consequences at all, and you just get angry, and it's tragic, because someone dies, but invariably we will catch and we will convict the people that have killed them, and then that person's life is ruined as well, and all of their family's lives is ruined, let alone the other family, and then within communities. And the most tragic thing for me is when you look at, you know, you drop that little pebble in about the murder or the stabbing, and then you look at how far those ripples go and how many people are affected by the fact that that's happened. It's extraordinary. So that's the other one. And the other big misconception is it will make me safer if I've got a knife, because it invariably won't. Because the problem is, if you've got a knife on you, you're going to be more inclined to produce that weapon. You produce that weapon when you get into a conflict, and then everyone is now suddenly escalating, and before you know it, people are actually attacking one another. And then you end up in the scenario that you end up in, often, sadly. So I think, but if there's one message, that it would be that key one: there is no safe place to stab somebody, because you just simply don't know what the implications of that are going to be.
Yeah. What is your main advice for anyone carrying a knife, or for anyone who is thinking about carrying a knife?
It's just, please don't, really. I mean, you know, really don't, because it's not going to protect you, and it may end up that you end up in a scenario that's so much worse. Because as soon as, being innocent and I pull my knife out, then whoever is confronting me, the ante has been raised with them. So I really would suggest to people not to carry a knife. And if you know people that are regularly carrying them, try and convince them that that is not a sensible option. Now, I know what people will come back and say is, yeah, but I'm not safe, I don't feel safe, there's no way I can feel safe. And you've got to try and deal with that situation. Local police are there to be spoken to. Of course, you're not going to have a police officer on every street all the time, but you can talk to local police, you can give concerns about a place where you're worried. If it's going back and forth to school, then you need to be talking to the schools as well. And some schools are doing great work in terms of how they work with us and with our schools officers and protect pupils, you know, on their way to school, after school and during. But it's just never going to end well if you carry a knife. And even if you start innocently and you're the one that ends up stabbing somebody, then that has all sorts of enormous consequences. And it's so difficult to get that message across to people, because it makes them feel powerful or it makes them feel safer, but it really isn't. And just think about, if I'm going to carry it, am I really going to be prepared to use this? And all that goes with preparing to use that. Because let alone the criminal justice consequences, you know, do most people want on their conscience that they killed somebody? or that they, you know, that they seriously injured somebody. I don't think most people would want that on their conscience. Don't get me wrong, there's a bad group who they're out there to do harm, and we know that, and we need to deal with those. But I do think there is a large group of people in amongst all of this who are not in that way. But if you've got it in your pocket, when you get angry, or when you've got drunk, or when you're on whatever, or the whole situation goes, if you haven't got it in your pocket, you're not going to end up using it, and you're not going to end up escalating. If you have, you might, and that's, and it can be just so horrible.
Yeah. What are the main ways in which the Met Police support a victim of the knife?
So we will always work with with any victim of crime. I have to say, in a lot of cases where you're getting into the knife crime, particularly within people who are involved in gangs and drugs, they don't want much to do with us. But we also work with loads of other organisations that will try and help people. And I know, you know, one of the things that you sent through talked about this kind of concept of the teachable moment. And we work with organisations that... So we do programmes. So we do a programme called Divert, which works in our custody centres. So when someone comes in, a young person involved in violence, we have the divert workers who are in the custody cell, and they'll start talking to those young people about, right, how do we get you out of this situation where you're getting involved in this kind of crime? We work with other charities that will work with people who've been involved in violence. We work with the hospitals. So if someone ends up over the road in St. Thomas's at the A&E on the casualty, then that's a moment where they hopefully will be thinking about, do I want my life to carry on like this? So we work with organisations that are in the hospitals, and they're kind of youth intervention groups, gang intervention groups that will go in and try and offer these people a chance to get out of the existence they're in. Because I think many of them, and I've worked for years with gang members of all descriptions, and most of them want to get out of the situation they're in, but they just can't see a route that you do that. And if you're in that kind of place where you are one of the players, and you've got a reputation, they're almost forced into acting in the way they act. Because if you don't, you've lost everything. And how you find... So these groups, we work with all those groups. We will obviously support the families of... certainly any victim of murder. We would support those families in the way that we do in any case with family liaison officers who work really closely. And we work with all other agencies that will come in to try and provide support and ongoing support. But really, with these kind of victims, it's about trying to get them out of that behaviour. Because very sadly, many of our victims are also our suspects, and many of our suspects have also been victims, because they're in this world where behaving in this way is sadly how it is. So trying to find them a way out, and that then comes into, you know, finding a way so their life chances can be changed. And that really comes out of being able to get jobs, or maybe education, but often what they're after is trying to find jobs. It's trying to find housing, because if you're just going to go straight back into the estate where you lived and where all of this has been what you've been doing, it's really hard to extricate yourself from that. We work with lots of mentoring programs where you can try and find... There's some great people out there who have been, you know, been violent offenders, been gang members, been all sorts of things, who are now working with young people to try and get them into a place and deal with those underlying factors. So that whole point about the masculinity thing and what is it to be a man, loads of great groups working with that to try and get these youngsters to realise being a man is not about being powerful and exerting control over other people. It's much more than that. And then just working with groups that try to get to those underlying issues. Because one of the things that there's a lot of work being done at the moment is around what are known as trauma-informed approaches, where a lot of these, particularly young people that are getting involved in this, are a kind of consequence of the lives they've had to lead. And there's a phenomenon called adverse childhood experiences. I don't know if you've heard that. So ACEs, A-C-E-s. And there's a load of work being done by a lot of psychologists and various others, which is saying, you know, if you grow up and you're, as a child, you are having all these adverse experiences, so you're watching domestic abuse in the household, you're watching violence all the time in the streets, you're not being looked after yourself as a child, you're seeing traumatic things, then that inevitably is impacting the way that you are then going to behave. So there's a lot of work to... So this concept of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and they did a big bit of work down in South Wales, and they went into some of the prisons down there, and they, you know, the percentage of prisoners that you could say have been subjected to adverse childhood experience was extraordinary. And but so therefore, little wonder that they then find themselves in the kind of situation they're in. And there's a whole load of neuroscience about if people's, you know, if they're not properly looked after in the early years of life, then that has a physical impact on your brain and your ability then to deal with conflict and to deal with situations where you become aggressive. So there's a whole load of science there as well. But it's just, we work with loads of different groups to try and find people a way to get out of this situation, because that's where we've got to get to. Because quite honestly, by the time we're arresting people for stabbing one another, it's kind of too late. And what we need to be doing is getting in much earlier, so that these youngsters who are now 4, 5, 6 and 7 are not going to be the kids in 8 and 10 years' time who are running around with knives and getting themselves into all sorts of harm. And so that, so we do lots of work with that, but we need to be, it's other people need to help us as well, because that's not, we're not professionals at that. And, you know, our primary job is still getting hold of people when they're hurting one another, because that's the only, that's the bit we can only do, or only us can do. So that's where we do, but we do lots of work with other people.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. I have 2 more questions for you. The first one, what are your thoughts on the public health approach to the helping solve the problems?
Yeah, and that's kind of what I've just been getting into a bit. Yeah. I don't particularly like that public health term, if I'm honest, because lots of people use it now, and I'm not sure they all mean exactly the same thing. But what it means for me is saying, yes, you've got to deal with the symptom, which in this case is the violence, and we have to do our bit. And I make no apologies that we go out there and we're going to arrest lots of people, and we're going to search people, and we're going to search houses, and we're going to do everything we can do to disrupt it and stop people hurting one another. So that's important. But what a public health approach says is, that's great, but what you've really got to do is stop, you know, stop the illness in the first place, if you like. And that for me is all that we were just talking. So that is, from the earliest age, how are we getting people to understand the dangers of being involved in this? How are we making sure that all the different agencies, plus their families or whatever circumstance they've got, are doing their best to stop them drifting down? Because it is incredibly hard, once you're in that world, to get out. And then once you've been arrested a few times, or you've got a criminal record, that then makes it harder to get a job. It makes it harder to change your life, which then puts you back into the system where, well, the best way I can earn money is go and work for that drug dealer. Because if I go and work for that drug dealer, I'll have 500 quid in my pocket at the end of the week, and I'll be someone because I'm part of that crew, and I get all the best girls, and I get money, and I've got protection. Why would I not do that? If I'm 15, 16 years old, I'm not going to go to university. I'm not going to go and get a great job. I'm not going to go off and become a doctor. They don't even see that world as being there for them. They see, I'm going to go and end up in some boring job that I don't want to do, that doesn't pay a load of money. Or I can go and work for him and have some status and have some power and have cash and be somebody. And I think, so you've got to get into that place. You've got to get back and work out, right, what can we all do? Which is about education and how schools can help. So one of the real challenges we face at the moment is the percentage of the children that we are seeing hurting one another or being hurt that are excluded from school. They are not in a full-time place in education. And I get that. The schools want to do the best they can for their class 30. And if you've got those 2 boys in that group that are constantly disrupting it, being violent, acting, you know, being violent to teachers, that are, I understand why the best thing to do is get them out of that classroom, because then the other 28 can actually get on and fulfil their potential. But the problem is there's not enough of a good system to look after those two. And they then end up, and I know, you know, they go to, often they'll go to what we call, well, what are called pupil referral units, where there'll be all the kids that are not in, they've been excluded from school. But they need to be really, really looked after. And those pupil referral units try really hard, but I don't think they've got enough funding to do what they need to do. I don't think they've got the resource to do it. And then if you're a person who's running a drugs operation and you want some foot soldiers, that's a good place to go and recruit them. Go and stand outside there. because these kids are looking for a meaning. And so I agree with it, but we need to do that. So schools we need to do. You know, again, you go back over the last 10 years where we've had the period of austerity. Youth services have been decimated, quite frankly. You know, social services, youth services have all been under enormous pressure because the local authorities have had to reduce and reduce and reduce what they've got. So it's really challenging, but that's the only way that we can get. And then the other thing that you need to do is support those people, often the third sector organisations on the ground that are really doing the interventions and helping. Because, you know, it's great me going and talking to a bunch of youngsters from a particular housing estate. They were all African Caribbean boys. They might listen to me, they might not, but it's going to be hard for me to get a message right across to them. But you get a youth worker who understands their life, who's lived their life. You get someone who's been in their world, been to prison, done this stuff. That's when you start to have an impact on them. And then you're mentoring these young people. Because the biggest shame of all for me, of all of it, is it's just such a waste of young people. Because actually, when you look at what they do, if you're working in one of those gangs, you know, you are having to show quite a lot of courage. You are risk-taking. You are entrepreneurial. You are thinking about all the angles. You're constantly, you know, you put it in a business sense, and you've got people attacking your business left, right and centre. Your market's really difficult. There's loads of other people trying to... These are very kind of bright. They might not be academically achieving, but a lot of them are really bright. And they're having to think on their feet and work, move real fast. And it's just a shame if we could only get them to do that in the legitimate side of the line. Lots of them could go and do amazing things, I'm sure. But the problem is they're on the illegitimate side of the line. And then you end up with all the harm that kind of comes. So I very much support public health. The Mayor of London is just launching the Violence Reduction Unit, which is literally just about to start, which is entirely about delivering, getting all those different agencies and groups and health and education and social services and youth services and police and everyone together to start looking at how do we make this work. So I do support it, but it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to achieve.
Thank you. I think so. You answered to the last question is because the last question is was it really take the generation to help to fix the knives now?
I don't.
So this is the same one. I think
I don't think it will take a generation, but I think we've got to be realistic that this is not a short term fix, because the short term fix you can impose on this is us. So as we have done over the last year, we have massively increased our resource that's tackling violence. You know, you will have heard of the Violent Crime Task Force, and the whole of the Met Police has been attacking the violence issue, and we've achieved some really good reductions. But that is right here and now, and we can keep that going, and we will keep that going to some extent, but you can't keep that going for the next 15 years. The whole point about the public health type approach and what we want to do with the violence reduction is we've got to get to that next generation of people so that we're not back where we were. Because I remember years ago when I was running Trident, which is the gang crime command, and, you know, we would measure ourselves on how many people we were arresting and how many operations we were running and how many people we were locking up. And that's all important. But I kept saying, you know, the key measure for us is in 5 years' time, if you're a 14-year-old black boy growing up on a particular housing estate in Stockwell, you're not naturally drawn into becoming a gang member. That's real success for us if we've managed to change that. And you can't do that quickly. And I got very frustrated when the mayor was attacked when he talked about 10 years. And I felt a little bit guilty as well, because I've sat around the group that was designing the violence reduction unit. And some of the politicians, because they do, were talking about, you know, 2 years, 3 years. And there were me and a few of the youth workers said, well, we've got to accept that this is probably going to be 10 years before you've really got what we want to do up and running and sustainable and really embedded. And the mayor quite rightly made that comment and then got a load of criticism as if he was just going to wait for 10 years, which was very unfair, because what he recognised was we've got to be honest about that, because we're not going to turn this around and fundamentally change things in 2 years. But in 10 years, if everyone really stuck to what they ought to do, then you might start to see a really tangible, because what I don't want to see is exactly the kind of what your question implies is we drop it down now and then we toddle along a little bit and then in 5 years' time it goes another big spike. because it's just over, well, no, it's about 10 years. The last time we had a really big panic about violence was in 2008. Yeah, 2007 or 2008, one of the two, when we had about 29 young people murdered over the summer period in London, including three that got a load of, you might have heard of Jimmy Mizzen, was a young boy down in southeast London that got a load of attention. And then there was another boy that was murdered, and his sister was an actress on EastEnders or something, and that got a load of attention. And then suddenly everyone wanted to talk about it. And that again takes you back into my point about this is about, a lot of this is about life chances. You look at the communities that are most affected by this, and they are generally the communities where they are under most challenge in terms of their life opportunities. So we had that, and then lots was done, and then it kind of bubbles along, and then all of a sudden we've now, for a whole range of other reasons, I think a bit of the austerity, a bit of social media, a bit of all sorts of other factors have come into play, different drug markets, etc. But we need to do something sustainable, and that you're not going to do that overnight, because you're talking about fairly radical change in places. And some of these places are just hard, and they always have been. You know, I grew up in some of the places I grew up in South London are still the places that are difficult now. You know, some of them are better, some of them are different, but there's, you know, there is, in some places there is just, they're the people who've got the hardest chances, really. And unfortunately, in those places, that attracts you to the criminality, which now attracts you to some of the violence, and you get into this kind of cycle. And so that's why I think it's not a whole and it's certainly not saying, well, the current generation are just kind of, we've just got to give up on them, because that's not true at all. But I think if we're realistic about how long it will take, we need to, and from a police point of view, you've got to lock the politicians into that as well. Because politicians, with the best will in the world, see things in electoral cycles. And for most politicians, saying to them, it's all going to be good in 10 years, they're not interested in that because they'll be gone in 10 years' time. That said, and I want to be really clear, the mayor is absolutely committed to this, genuinely committed to this, as is the deputy mayor for policing, Sophie Linden. You know, they are both intellectually and emotionally invested in this. You know, he speaks to the families of all the young people that are killed personally, and, you know, and will sit down with those people and listen to what they have to say. So this is not something that he's just doing because, you know, because he ought to. He genuinely is committed to this, as is Sophie. And they're committed to the fact it's going to be, and it will outlive him and her as an issue. But we've just got to constantly keep at it, because quite frankly, where we really don't want to end up is where you are in some of those American cities. You know, despite what some of the media would have you believe, we really don't want to be in a place where you're talking about the kind of numbers that they talk about in cities over there.
Assistant Commissioner Martin Schuett, thank you very much for taking time out for the London School of Science and Technology on behalf of all of our staff and students. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.